Okay, we're going to come to order. Good morning, everybody. And we're going to start. We have three proclamations to read, and I'm going to recognize Commissioner Fish first for Reuse Week proclamation.
Thank you, Dan. Do we have someone here for reuse? Is Andy here? No. Perhaps he's delayed, so I'll just go ahead and read the proclamation. And if Andy Olds from Community Warehouse gets here, we'll have him come up and say a few words. This represents our fourth annual Reuse Week, and I'm proud of the growth of the coalition that's come together. In 2009, Community Warehouse Executive Director Christy Wood shared her vision for a more collaborative reuse community and kicked off the first Reuse Week. And in 2010, Reuse PDX was born. Last year, our reuse community formalized the National Reuse Alliance. This year, Portland will host the coveted reuse conference, Reuse Conex. I'm proud to support the reuse community and read this proclamation in recognition of their work on behalf of the mayor. Whereas since 2009, Reuse Week has celebrated the values of sustainability and community building, and the local organizations that bring them to life through sharing, borrowing, and swapping goods. And whereas the recently established Oregon chapter of the Reuse Alliance was selected to host the Reuse Alliance's semi-annual Reuse Connects conference this month in Portland, and whereas the conference hosted by local nonprofits Community Warehouse, Scrap, and the Habitat for Humanity Restore will bring hundreds of reuse professionals to Portland, and whereas the centerpiece of the conference will be the Reuse Expo at the Doubletree Lloyd Center on October 20th, featuring reuse-based exhibitors, a refashion show, and a re-art exhibit, along with reuse workshops. And whereas the Reuse Alliance Oregon chapter furthers the city and county's climate action plan goals of reducing local carbon emissions by 80% by 2050, decreasing total solid waste generated by 25% by 2030, and minimizing carbon emissions from waste disposal. And whereas the Environmental Protection Agency reports that sending 10,000 pounds of material to an incinerator creates one job, sending it to the landfill creates six jobs, recycling creates 36 jobs, and reusing it creates anywhere from 28 to 300 jobs. And whereas together with our reuse partners, the Portland City Council and the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners will work to promote the value of reuse and increase its understanding and practice in Portland and Multnomah County. Now, therefore, I, on behalf of Sam Adams, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim October 17 through October 23, 2012, to be Portland's fourth annual Reuse Week and encourage all residents to join in the observance. Congratulations to everyone at Reuse.
Thank you, Commissioner Fish. Our next proclamation, Commissioner Amanda Fritz will read.
Thank you, President Salzman. Is somebody from OHSU here? Please come on forward. It gives me great satisfaction to read this proclamation. And you can just have a seat. That's wonderful. Thank you. It gives me very great satisfaction to read this proclamation on behalf of Mayor Adams. Whereas Oregon Health and Science University, OHSU, has achieved designation as a magnet hospital from the American Nurses Credentialing Center, which is the highest distinction that a hospital can receive for nursing excellence. And whereas the center's commission on magnet designation decision was unanimous, and whereas Oregon Health and Science University is one of only five hospitals in Oregon to receive this designation, and whereas Oregon Health and Science University is among only 6% of the nation's hospitals recognized as a magnet facility, and whereas magnet designation provides Oregonians with the ultimate benchmark to measure the quality of care that they can expect to receive, and whereas the compassionate, caring, expertise, intelligence, knowledge, and passion of OHSU's 2,400 nurses have benefited thousands of Oregon's residents and their families, and whereas Oregon Health and Science University invites friends of OHSU and the entire university community to celebrate this special award on October 17, 2012, and to honor nursing excellence, in which registered nurses strive to provide safe and reliable patient care and map out the way to improve our healthcare system. I'm going to ad lib another whereas. Whereas the Oregon, the nurses at the Oregon Health and Science University are represented by the Oregon Nurses Association, of which Amanda Fritz is a very proud continuing member. Now, therefore, Sam Adams, the mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, does hereby proclaim October 17th, 2012, to be OHSU Magnet Recognition Day in Portland and encourages all residents to join in this observance. Would you like to tell folks a little more about what this means to you and what it means to, what is magnet designation and how it took 10 years for us to achieve it, right? Just a couple of words about that.
Give us your name, too.
My name is Basilia Basin, and I'm a nurse at OHSU. And magnet designation is a really prestigious designation to really represent nursing excellence and our commitment to patient quality care and compassion. And we were above and beyond in our abilities to demonstrate that to the magnet committee. We were on this journey for 10 years, and finally our everything aligned so that we were able to meet the requirements in order to apply for magnet designation, and we've put a lot of hard work into this, and our nurses are very proud to finally receive this designation. Thank you.
Thank you. Would you like to add anything?
And I'm Sharon Dunham, and I've been on this journey since its inception with the Memorandum of Understanding 10 years ago, and I will echo everything that Basilia said. In addition, this is a journey. This does not end here. The bar is set even higher for our next achievement of this, and so we continue to strive for any excellence that we can do. And it's not just nursing, it's everyone at OHSU.
Thank you so much. Colleagues, if you wouldn't mind getting a photograph with our guests, I would really appreciate it.
Okay, we saved the best proclamation for the last, and that is Mary Beth Henry Appreciation Day. So come on up, Mary Beth Henry. So Mary Beth Henry, as we all know, is the head of the Office for Community Technology, and recently won the very prestigious Herman Curley Award from the League of Oregon Cities as Outstanding Public Employee. And so we're proclaiming today Mary Beth Henry Appreciation Day, and I'm going to read the proclamation. Whereas the League of Oregon Cities prestigious 2012 Herman Curley Award was presented to Mary Beth Henry, the City of Portland's Manager of the Office for Community Technology, during the League's 87th annual conference, and whereas the award is given to a city employee who has made exceptional contributions to city government in Oregon, producing lasting benefits for their local community, and whereas for more than 20 years, Mary Beth Henry has served as a tireless leader and advocate for local governments and public interests in technology issues, including advocating for community broadband, maintaining local control, and ensuring payment of fair rent by private companies using valuable public rights of way. And whereas locally, she was a key leader in multiple efforts to bring increased broadband resources to Portland and outlying communities, and currently provides leadership and management for the city's broadband strategic plan, a model for cities in Oregon and across the United States. And whereas, at the state level, Mary Beth Henry has been recognized for excellence in telecommunications legislation, and in 2010 was appointed by the governor to represent Oregon cities on the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council, where she was elected vice chair by her colleagues. And whereas nationally, Mary Beth Henry has represented and advocated for local governments in front of the U.S. Congress and the Federal Communications Commission, and served as president of the National Association of Telecommunications Officers and Advisors, known as NATOA, and was awarded life membership in 2010. So now, therefore, I, Sam Adams, mayor of the city of Portland, the City of Roses, congratulates Mary Beth Henry on her prestigious award and thank her for her excellent work on behalf of all Portlanders, and do hereby proclaim Wednesday, October 17th, 2012, to be Mary Beth Henry Appreciation Day in Portland, and encourage all residents to join in observance. Congratulations. Would you like to say a few words?
Thank you, Commissioner Saltzman. I'm really deeply honored by this recognition today, and I do believe that it is a reflection of the importance of our work, charging fair rent for private profit-making use of public property, and ensuring abundant, affordable broadband for all of our citizens. It's also a reflection of the opportunities that I've been given and the amazing people with whom I've had the good fortune to work. I'd like to thank Commissioners Fritz and Saltzman for your support and leadership on broadband and digital equity. And I'd also like to thank my staff in the Office for Community Technology who are with me here today. Please stand. Yay! Without whom this would not be possible. I'd also like to recognize my new boss and coworkers in the Revenue Bureau, the new location for Office for Community Technology, who are also here. I'd also like to thank David Olson, a former director of the Cable Office, and finally, the Mount Hood Cable Regulatory Commission, which consistently supports community interests in communications. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
How about a Mary Beth? How about a picture with the council here? So. Now we'll begin our formal business. Carla, could you please call the roll?
Leonard?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Saltzman?
Here.
Adams?
Okay, we'll begin with communications, item 1157.
Request Daniel Hall to address council regarding Portland's climate action plan and high carbon fuels.
Welcome.
Good morning.
You could just give us your name, and you have 3 minutes, and there's a clock right in front of you.
Yep. Good morning. My name is Daniel Hall. I'm an independent environmental policy analyst, and I'm here this morning representing myself and the environmental group Forest Ethics. We would like to work with you to protect the effectiveness of the city's landmark climate action plan by shifting the city's use of petroleum fuel away from sources that have exceptionally high carbon footprints and other exceptionally high environmental and social impacts. One important component of the city's climate action plan is reducing the carbon footprint of transportation fuels by 20%. However, it'll be difficult to achieve this goal through steps like vehicle efficiency when the carbon footprint of these fuels is otherwise likely to grow by as much as 300 to 500%. The solution is for Portland to join other cities and companies to more actively avoid high carbon fuels. So let me flesh this out a bit. In Alberta, Canada, a forest the size of Maine is being clear cut, strip mined, and drilled for injection wells so that synthetic crude oil can be cooked out of the underlying tar sands. Cooking the oil out of the ground and converting it to oil uses massive quantities of natural gas, so much so that the tar sands fuel has a greenhouse gas footprint that is 300 to 500 times that of normal petroleum oil. There are other impacts, of course, wildlife habitat loss, immense toxic tailings ponds, and increased air pollution at refineries, including here at the U.S.
Carla, is that the mic? You think should we try a different mic because it keeps? All right. Sorry, it keeps breaking up a little bit.
Tar sands oil is almost certainly finding its way into Portland's fuel supply and will likely increase if action is not taken. 90% of the state's petroleum comes from Washington refineries, all of which take inputs from the tar sands, and most of which get their tar sands inputs via the Trans Mountain Pipeline, which is scheduled to double its capacity. Portland's climate plan calls for increased vehicle efficiency, biofuels, and ethanol and diesel and gasoline. These are great steps. But the more that the remaining petroleum content of the city's fuel comes from the tar sands, the more that these steps will be offset and negated by the tar sands' exceptionally high carbon content. Forest Ethics, the Sierra Club, NRDC, and other environmental groups are working with the cities of Portland, Maine, Seattle, Bellingham, Washington, and Vancouver, BC, to help them take action. And a growing number of U.S. companies, including Walgreens, Chiquita, Whole Foods, and Trader Joe's, are also taking action. We hope that Portland will join them to take steps to minimize tar sands inputs in the city's fuel supply chain, to protect the effectiveness of the city's climate action plan, and to help protect forests, water, air quality by reducing the market demand for this toxic fuel. Thank you. We're already in touch with the mayor's staff, and we look forward to working with you as this proceeds, and hopefully we'll get a photo op.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hall. Very much. Carla, could you read 1158, please?
Request of Sarah Hobbs to address council regarding how the city treats the homeless.
Welcome.
Good morning.
If you could just give us your name, and then you have 3 minutes, and the clock's right in front of you.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Sarah Hobbs. And recently at the opening of the streetcar, I was hoping the mayor would be here. I see he's not. But as he was leading the marching band from Momsey down to the streetcar during the opening, he looked straight at me and asked me how I was doing. And the reality is I am quite angry at things that I have seen that have been done to the homeless here in Portland. For the record, I am housed. I have never been unhoused. But I have come very close twice due to domestic violence of being homeless. So the homeless issue is something that I take very seriously. Recently, I was out talking to some of my homeless friends early in the morning out across the street as they were out camping out in front of Chapman Park. They were out on the sidewalk. They were not in the park. I had begun to leave when I noticed two Portland police officers had come up, and I stopped, and I watched. I watched the officers. You could say they didn't kick them hard, but they still kicked a number of the homeless that were asleep on the sidewalk to wake them up. A number of them woken up out of a sound sleep, woke up combative, and there was heated discussion between the police officers and the homeless. I know when I get woken up out of a sound sleep, having PTSD, I become very combative. It's not that I want to be combative. It's just a reaction having PTSD. I saw the police force people to move their stuff, saying they were beyond the curb boundary, and forced them to move their stuff, saying they were in violation of the law just because they were that far over the code. I watched one person jiggled out of a sound sleep. They woke up, something fell out of their pocket. They were arrested on something that the city considers illegal. But it fell out of their pocket when they woke up, you know, very disoriented and combative. But they were kicked and woken up out of a sound sleep. I've watched others concerned that if they leave their stuff alone on the sidewalk just for minutes, that it's going to be confiscated. And I question, when has homelessness been illegal? Clearing out the streets in front of City Hall, Chapman Park, Lonsdale Square, Having downtown look clean doesn't mean the problem is going away. Forcing it out to East County does not mean the problem is going away. And this issue of the homeless needs to be addressed. It is a real problem. Let's not just try to cover it up and think it's going to go away. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hobbs. If you could read our next communication.
1159, request of David Gwyther to address council regarding ground transportation issue.
Welcome, Mr. Gwyther.
May I have also a few seconds to thank a retiring commissioner for his service to Portland, first
sure.
as
well,
a Marine.
Why don't you go ahead and just give us your name, and then you'll,
oh, David,
you'll,
I'm sorry,
you'll
David
have 3 minutes.
David Gwyther. I wanted to thank Commissioner Leonard for his service, first as a Marine, second as a firefighter union rep, and a state legislator, and now a commissioner. And I'm a lease driver at Radio Cab, and we'd like to offer him a position afterwards, of course. Okay. And that brings me to my point. Radio Cab was founded by veterans after World War II, Korea, we have veterans, Viet vets, et cetera. I'm not a representative. I'm just a lease driver that happens to be politically involved. We compete, as Commissioner Salzman pointed out in his letter, to the group that spent 2 years trying to come up with recommendations for permits with numerous forms of transportation, rent-a-cars, Zipcar, Car2Go. TriMet has not only their own fleet of vehicles for medically indigent people or medically necessary transportation, but they also subcontract with a group. These are all contracts that used to be part of the cab business that aren't anymore. The streetcar loop, when that gets completed, it's going to be a real boon to Portland, no question about it. But it's also rides that cabs don't take any, won't be taking very much over to OMSI, et cetera. Would you rather take your kids in a cab or on the streetcar? Streetcar is much more fun. So unfortunately, we've inadvertently created one of the best environments for tourists, et cetera. But as a cab driver, there are certain things that have been done and not done that, in some cases, inadvertently make it hard to do business. For example, the fellow in charge of our industry recently said you can't flag a cab. Well, that's not true. Otherwise, Green Cab, that only gets 1.5 calls per cab per day, would have a very hard time making a living. They set out at the airport or in the stands downtown because nobody wants to call them. 20 years ago, I remember the hearing where they got their permits. They had lots of great ideas. They were going to be owned by the drivers. They're going to be non-smoking, et cetera, et cetera. They're going to serve the Northeast. That went by the wayside as soon as they got out to the airport. The only way you can get a cab in Northeast Portland, a green cab, is to throw yourself on the hood while they're going to the airport. Anyway, we're in a situation now where they've spent 2 years making recommendations. At radio, I know for a fact you have to go through a lottery to get a cab on the weekends. And what are we going to tell the vets that are coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq? You have to go to Solidarity Cab because we've decided that this is a better way to do things. Those cabs are already full from what I understand. So if you want to do it right, take the permits away from Broadway, allow Solidarity to form, and make it work that way, because otherwise you're going to inundate the market with cabs. Now, unfortunately, there's only two things we can do to influence you. At the ballot box, and unfortunately, Commissioner Fritz is the only one up for election, and we're working on that. She's seen Radio Cab. I remember taking her over there the first time around. Or litigation, and yeah, I think you have enough lawsuits. Last time I checked, you have a very active, a lot of litigation going on. It wouldn't take a plaintiff's lawyer more than a few, read through the law. It's based on need for the customers in terms of expansion of the fleet. We Radio Cab can show need because of our computer system. We log all the calls in, et cetera. But anyway, I'm in a situation now where, I'd like to retire when I'm 72.
By the way, you have to wrap up. I've let you go 30 seconds beyond your time.
I hope we get a hearing so I can expand induced charts and graphs.
I believe we'll have a hearing on November 7th.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And now we'll move to the consent agenda. Is there anybody that wishes to have an item removed from the consent agenda? Okay, hearing no objections. If you could please call the roll on the consent agenda.
I would like to remove an item.
Okay, which item?
1171.
Okay, I think, Carly, you'll read the item, and then we'll pull
it. That's on regular agenda.
Oh, it's on regular agenda.
Yep.
So you'll have a chance to testify on that. Okay, so no other items? Nope. Nothing pulled from the consent. Please call the roll.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye. Okay, the consent agenda is approved, and we'll move to our, we have no time certain, so we move to our regular agenda, item 1169. Second reading, vote only.
Amend the comprehensive plan and zoning map for properties along and near Southeast 122nd Avenue between Powell Boulevard and Foster Road.
Okay, please call the roll.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
This is another great collaboration between the community around 122nd and the Planning Bureau and others. And the Office of Neighborhood Involvement. I greatly appreciate everybody's work. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Well, good work to the Bureau of Planning Sustainability and also all the East Portland neighbors who were so active in this. Aye. Okay, it's approved, and we move on to 1170, which is also a second reading.
Ratify a successor collective bargaining agreement between the city on behalf of the Portland Fire and Rescue and Portland Firefighters Association relating to the terms and conditions of employment of represented employees in the Portland Firefighters Association bargaining unit for 2012-2016.
Please call the roll.
Leonard?
I'm one of those people who sometimes makes remarks and then later realizes I left things out. Last week, after thanking the Firefighters Association for their work, I overlooked thanking Anna Canwett, who marked this as her first a successful collective bargaining agreement, and her team, Jarrell and others that worked on it, and they the remarks that I attributed to the firefighters for their collaboration and willingness to compromise equally apply to Anna and her team. So I appreciate greatly all of their efforts in bringing us this successful collective bargaining agreement. Aye.
Fritz.
I appreciate all the effort that went into this. I think next year we need to have a discussion of how contracts are negotiated and when council is notified. There's some things in this tentative agreement that I am concerned about, particularly premium pay for public information officers in the Fire Bureau. I recognize that it's been reached by a collective bargaining process. The challenge is making sure that elected officials are involved at the appropriate time. And as I said, we'll work on that next year. Aye.
Fish.
Aye.
Saltzman.
Aye. Okay, the agreement is ratified. And we move on to item 1171.
Authorize the Portland Water Bureau to purchase property located near the Bull Run watershed to enhance protection of the watershed, secure right-of-ways for the conduit routes, contribute to Endangered Species Act compliance, and provide for payment.
Commissioner Leonard.
I'm going to turn this over to David Schaff, but also want to recognize the success that that the Water Bureau has achieved in adding to the lands that have been acquired over the past century plus to further insulate the watershed that we get our pristine water from public intrusion by the acquisition of lands when they come up for sale. So this is another great example of the Water Bureau proactively looking to acquire more properties that are contiguous to the Bull Run watershed. So I want to, in advance, thank them for their work.
Thank you.
I'm David Schaff. I'm the director of the Portland Water Bureau. With me are Eddie Campbell, the director of the Resource Protection and Planning Group, and Tom Klutz, our property manager for the Bureau. And before I start, I'll just make a comment. I'm going to do a quick PowerPoint. I know that my boss is not a fan of them, but they're good, instructive slides. And then just a comment about the earlier commenter. As much as I appreciate Randy's service, I would not recommend him as a cab driver. I've ridden with the commissioner, and I just think it's a bad idea. So I'm hoping he finds something else.
About a pilot? Pilot?
No.
Oh, okay.
So, Carla?
I guess scratch it
up. I'm already there. So, let's make sure I can work this thing. What are we here for? We're proposing to purchase approximately 205 acres of private land previously owned by PGE, adjacent to and inside the Bull Run Management Unit. It's for this fiscal year's budget, and the current cost, or the cost, is not to exceed $1.65 million. We have negotiated the sale for $1.587 million, and there's about $60,000 in the not-to-exceed cap to cover potential closing and escrow costs that at this point are still estimated. So let's give a little background. Excuse me. PGE first announced in 1999 that it would close its Bull Run hydroelectric facilities in the Sandy River Basin and remove the Marmot and Little Sandy River dams and their related equipment. The two dams, Marmot and Little Sandy, were decommissioned in 2007 and 2008, and PGE divested itself of just over 1,100 acres of land in the Sandy River Basin, including land located in the Bull Run Management Unit, excuse me, and the Lower Bull Run Watershed, Portland's primary drinking water source. These properties were donated to the Western Rivers Conservancy, WRC, a nonprofit land conservancy. An excerpt from the WRC website says, Western Rivers Conservancy identifies key riverlands, enters into negotiations with private landowners, including corporations, families, and utilities, and creates strategies to purchase and conserve those sensitive riverlands by transferring them to public or private stewards for long-term conservation and management. So this has been in the works for well over a decade from the time that PGE announced that it would be divesting itself of these lands and donating them to WRC. We've been working with and negotiating with WRC on the purchase of some of these lands. Some of these lands are of significant interest to the Water Bureau as they're located adjacent to the Bull Run Management Unit and adjacent to city-owned land in the Lower Bull Run Watershed. It's extremely rare to have an opportunity to purchase land inside the watershed and inside the boundaries of the Bull Run Management Unit, and if we don't purchase them, these parcels could potentially be sold to private entities. So what's our rationale? We're looking at source water protection, regulatory compliance, operational efficiencies, and security. When WRC originally approached the Water Bureau with a proposal, they proposed that we purchase 270 acres of land. An analysis that we conducted concluded that of those 270 acres, approximately 181 acres were of value to us as the site of current and future critical water supply infrastructure. In addition, we're going to be acquiring approximately 24 acres at $1 per parcel. So that's five additional parcels at $1 per parcel, which amounts to 24 acres. Acquisition of these parcels will allow the Water Bureau to increase our watershed protection, decrease opportunities for trespass into the management unit. Acquiring these properties also contribute to satisfying some of the mandated conservation goals set out in the Bull Run Water Supply Habitat Conservation Plan. As you may remember, the HCP was passed by the Council in 2008, and its implementation brings the city into compliance with both the Federal Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act. So let's talk about each of those individual criteria. On source water protection, all non-federal lands in the Bull Run Watershed Management Unit will now be owned and protected by the City of Portland. So if it's not owned by the federal government, it will be owned by the City of Portland Water Bureau. water quality and natural habitat in the lower Bull Run and the lower and the Little Sandy Rivers will be protected. From a regulatory compliance standpoint, riparian habitat protection, as I said, will contribute to our Endangered Species Act compliance and the goals of our HCP that we passed in 2008. From an operational efficiency, the land on which we have water infrastructure will now be owned by the City of Portland. It will provide one of the parcels, and we'll get into the maps in a minute, will provide a site for staging of water system improvement projects, and it could be the site of a future location for the eventual replacement of our maintenance facility, which we refer to as Sandy River Station. From a security standpoint, this gives us better control of access to the Bull Run Management Unit main gate and one of the adjacent gates. Land adjacent to the southernmost gate, the Homestead Gate, will now be owned by the city, and it creates a bigger buffer zone between privately held land and our management unit. So let's get into the actual parcels. This is the Dodge Park area, the confluence of the Bull Run River and the Sandy River. This is an old PGE trolley route. Maybe Randy would recall. There was a trolley way back when. I don't know why I'm doing this.
I'm on my way out the door. Wow.
It's an old PG trolley.
Band-aids up here.
Used to ride it from the Irvington neighborhood out to Bull Run, right?
Whatever job security measures you put in his contract,
yeah.
I hope that's not a citywide policy.
It went all the way to Dodge Park. You'll see pictures of old trolley cars with Dodge Park as the destination. So that upper piece is PGE land. The land to the east of that is Camp Nemano, Camp Fire Girls. It's approximately 9 point some odd acres. And Conduit 3, as you can perhaps see, runs through right about the middle of it. And then the two smaller parcels are part of that PGE trolley line across the river and then in Dodge Park. So they're of very little value to anybody other than the Water Bureau. But they don't have a whole lot of timber value, and so the assessed value, or the value that we've gotten them from WRC, was $1 a piece. If you look at the next one, this is an interesting piece of property. It's 12 acres. It's that skinny little piece of land that borders the Bull Run River. It will be conveyed to the Bureau for $1. It consists of approximately 12 acres along the lower Bull Run. Ownership of this parcel will result in the ownership and protection of the riverbank of the entire lower Bull Run River from the management unit to its confluence with the Sandy River. The blue property over on the right is already Water Bureau property, and that purple hatched property is on the other side, the other bank of the river. So the entire Bull Run River on either side will be owned by the Portland Water Bureau and protected. The land to...
How wide is that little narrow span?
It's like a 20, 30 feet, something like that.
Oh, okay.
And on the other side of that, all of that property is owned by a timber company. So ownership and protection of this area will contribute to satisfying some of our mandated conservation goals set out in our HCP. The next parcel, Parcel E, is the largest parcel and the one that's of the most value. It's 140 acres approximately, and it's located just outside of the main gate on Waterworks Road. Its agreed upon valuation is approximately $1.1 million, and that's approximately the value of the timber harvest. All three of our conduits that carry water to Portland lay beneath some portion of this parcel. Conduit 3 crosses over the north portion. Conduits 2 and 4 cross over the very southern portions. In addition, the portion of this parcel near the entrance to the main gate has been identified as a possible site for the future relocation of our maintenance station, Sandy River. The current maintenance station is located on the opposite side of the Bull Run River, making access to the watershed by the main gate in the event of a road or bridge failure much more difficult. The current stations located in the Sandy River floodplain could be rendered inoperable or destroyed by flooding. Now, this is not something we have in our 5-year, our 10-year, our 15-year horizon. to move Sandy River Station. But it's a piece of property that's available now that makes sense for us to acquire so that when we can eventually move Sandy River Station to the entrance to the watershed, we will be able to. In addition, on the very southern, southeastern portion of that parcel is one of the alternate gates to entries to the Bull Run Management Unit in the event that the main gate's not accessible. I'm going to continue on with this parcel because it's the largest and the most valuable. This is what we refer to as Ditch Camp. Acquisition of this particular piece of property is one that we're very interested in. This is, if you've gone to the watershed, this is near the powerhouse, the Bull Run powerhouse, just as you cross over the Bull Run River. And that southern portion is very steep, prone to landslides. As a matter of fact, you have pictures here, and the next picture I'll show you are of landslides that have occurred in this area. We've gone through extensive efforts to stabilize, protect, and monitor the conduits that are running through this piece of property. And here you have an example where there's been a slide of some of the portion of the property. Our goal is to be able to own this property and then monitor it and maintain it so that our conduits are protected. You may remember my second year here working for the Water Bureau. The Ditch Camp project was one of those that we worked on to address our system vulnerability issues. These are conduits 2 and 4. They run through the lower portion of this parcel E. They used to be sitting up above ground. We rebuilt the cradles that they're in. We surrounded them with styrofoam blocks and then low-density fill concrete and then covered the conduits. This is an active landslide area, and owning this piece of property and doing the work we've done here helps protect those two conduits that bring water into Portland. Parcels F and G are approximately 37 acres. F is the upper one. It is located inside the Bull Run Management Unit. It shares a property line with City of Portland property already owned land, and it's adjacent to Parcel G. Its agreed upon value is $127,000. Parcel G, the lower one, is located adjacent to Parcel F, also partly inside the Bull Run Management Unit. Its agreed upon value is $363,000. Now, this is one of the areas where we worked with Western Rivers and Clackamas County to get a lot line adjustment, because if you see to the left of the Parcel G icon, that's pink shaded land, that's WRC land, that's land that they originally wanted us to purchase, and we said the cost of this is the cost of that would be too great, and we passed on that. And the reason we passed on that is because it's outside of the boundary unit. It doesn't include any of the riparian lands, and it doesn't help. That section wouldn't help us in our compliance with our HCP. However, parcels F and G do. The Little Sandy River runs through those parcels, and protection of the riverbank areas, and that will contribute to satisfying some of our obligations under the HCP. And then our last one is Parcel H. It's a very small 3-acre parcel. It's located entirely inside the Bull Run Management Unit, and it's surrounded by either Forest Service or the City of Portland land. It's worth approximately $15,000, and again, located on the Little Sandy River, and protection of the water, the riverbank areas here, again, contribute to our compliance on the HCP. So those are the properties, and either I or Eddie or Tom can answer any questions you may have.
Questions from the council? Mr. Fritz?
Thank you. That was a very helpful presentation, and the maps especially so. You said in the presentation that PGE donated the land to
WRC, yes.
So why do we have to buy it?
That's the business WRC is trying to protect lands and get them into public ownership. But then WRC will use that $1.58 million dollars and go to private owners and purchase their land. So their whole goal is to try and keep as much land in the public ownership as they can. And PGE wasn't going to donate it to the city of Portland.
That was my next question. Okay. Thank you. And which fund in the Water Bureau are you using for this?
It comes out of two different funds. Hold on. I have to look at my notes. It comes out of hang on. I have it in my I was just looking at it a minute ago. The one is the thank you. It comes out of our water quality and regulatory compliance program and our CIP adopted budget.
So do we have a special property acquisition fund?
We have funds that we so for instance, this one is in what's called the Water Quality and Regulatory Compliance Fund, and it's includes a significant amount of money for projects including land purchases. So it's not all associated to just land purchases. It includes HCP commitments, easements, land purchases, and projects jointly conducted with other watershed partners. This is the program that Eddie runs through the HCP.
And how do you determine how much money goes into that fund each year?
Well, as I said, we've been working on this project, this particular land acquisition, for over a decade. And in the last year, through our negotiations with the WRC, we've identified what the value of that land was and what it was going to cost us. So we've put money into that fund, and we're transferring money in the fall bump from one account to another account to make up the difference from what we were estimating last fiscal year to this fiscal year.
So you, as part of both the budget process and the capital improvement project process, you figure out how much you're going to need for upcoming
exactly.
purchases. Thank you.
Dave, I was just curious, in the exchange you had with Commissioner Fritz, in the Parks Bureau, we work with the Trust for Public Land that goes in and acquires sites on behalf of the public and as a placeholder. And you're using Western Rivers Conservancy. I assume they have a similar model.
I'm not familiar with Trust for Public Lands, but in this case, it was PGE that made the selection of Western Rivers.
Okay. And yeah. they effectively hold the land until they can affect one of these transactions.
That's correct.
And I can tell you from our experience with TPL that the benefit to the public is you don't have government coming in at the front end and negotiating, because oftentimes when people see the government come into these transactions, the price tends to go up. You have a third party handle a transaction. So that's what TPL does. That and I think that was the model, Dan, that we use with Riverview. When they acquired the dirt. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay, thank you all. Is there anybody signed up to testify on this item?
We have one person, Joe Walsh.
Joe, okay. Is there anybody else that wishes to testify? Okay, Joe, come on up. If you can just give us your name, you have 3 minutes.
Good morning. My name is Joe Walsh, and some of my questions were already answered by Commissioner Fritz. One of the things that I did not understand is the significance of this buy. This is $1.65 million. Now, I know that's not a lot of money to you guys, but it's a lot of money to me. You're buying it from a conservatory that their sole function is to protect the land. And yet, in the agenda, you seem to intimate that you're buying it to protect it. Why would you do that? Why would you buy land from an organization that their sole function is to protect it? The job is already being done, but we're going to spend $1.6 million to take that land and do exactly what the conservatory is already doing, because the land was donated. to them, and they hold it in protection to save the land, to comply with the different laws and regulations. So some of my questions have been answered. However, I'm very uncomfortable with this action because it doesn't make sense to me. If I want to protect something, I want to buy it from PG&E. I want to protect it from them. I don't want to take it away from a conservatory that their sole function is to protect the land and the rivers. There's something here that makes me nervous. And I don't think I can stop you from doing it because we can't stop the Water Department from doing anything. But I'm raising the objection.
Okay, duly noted. Thank you. Okay, there's no further testimony. This item moves to a second reading.
Well, let me just say, okay. I mean, if you were watching the presentation, you had to catch the part where we're going to do water improvement projects we couldn't otherwise do because we don't own the land.
So you're going to build.
You're
going to take it from the conservatory who's protecting it, and you're going to build.
Bury pipes, if you're watching.
And maintenance.
Mr. Walsh, you had your chance to speak. Let Commissioner Leonard.
Well, don't ask me the questions if you don't want the answers.
He's not asking you a question.
I'm not a ventriloquist. That's him talking. I was answering what you said.
Okay, so this will move to a second reading next week. Could you please read item 1172?
Assess benefited properties for water main improvements in the Delta Wood Phase 1 Local Improvement District.
And this will be set over a week until, this will be set over to next week?
Until right? next week, correct.
Okay, great. Okay, good breeze. Item 1173.
Amend various sections of the Public Works Improvement Code and Plumbing Regulations to implement the new policies related to the city's nonconforming sewer conservation program.
Well, I'm glad we have about an hour and a half because we'll need that full hour and a half here. In January 2008, the Bureau of Environmental Services started a nonconforming sewer program that required property owners to replace nonconforming connections and to pay a sewer connection charge. In response to widespread concerns and complaints from the public about the cost and the fairness of the program, in September of 2011, I directed the Bureau of Environmental Services to form a Citizens Advisory Committee to review the program and to recommend changes. The committee issued its report in March of 2012, and in response, BES proposed the following changes to the Portland City Code and administrative rules. To establish a branch fee charge instead of the sewer conversion charge for residential properties required to abandon nonconforming sewer connections, and to also establish a conforming connection to the public sewer. Establish reimbursements for residential property owners who have paid or financed sewer conversion fees since January of 2008. Create additional criteria and incentives for property owners to relinquish ownership to the city of private sewer lines in the public right-of-way and establish a process for the city to adopt private sewer lines in the public right-of-way. And with us is Lana Donaher of the Bureau of Environmental Services. Do you have anything you wish to add?
Well, I was just going to say a couple of things. Not much, I promise. It won't be an hour and a half. I was thinking more like 5 minutes.
Okay.
One of the most important things, I think, is I really want to thank Commissioner Salzman for his leadership in this, but especially a member of his staff, Amy True. She's just been a gem to work with, and the Citizen Advisory Committee and community members have developed a high level of trust in her. So I wanted to especially provide a thanks
to her.
It's
nice to see Amy get equal billing with Matt Grum. Finally getting her due.
Oh, and she's here, too, so she gets to hear that. A member of my staff gave her our internal shining star because of her work here, so I wanted you to know that. There have been, as you mentioned, significant changes made in response to the Citizen Advisory Committee, and, of course, I want to thank them as well for their amazing commitment because they really got into the weeds here. And there will be significant changes for, especially for residential owners. What this does not reflect is the, to the full extent, is the extent of the changes we've also made to our protocols and procedures to be what I call kinder and gentler, and also to make sure that we remain a high service agency that works with property owners to try to address their emergent and urgent needs that come about as a result of sales, conflicts with their neighbors, or broken private sewer lines, both on private property and in the right-of-way, which typically come as a huge surprise. This does not solve all the problems. You will probably still occasionally, hopefully very occasionally, have people who are upset because it is very upsetting to discover that the line you thought was connected to a public main in front of your house actually goes through an adjacent property owner who you may not get along with. We will still be involved with those and still have difficulties. But a lot of it will be less painful when they don't have many thousands of dollars to pay the city on top of private plumbing. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Alana?
Mr. Fritz? Just about the process, both of getting here and then from mm-hmm. here forward, who did you target the mailings to notify about this process?
Well, you know, we don't know who we don't know. So we did mailings both to those that are in our databases as suspected and known. We went through all the neighborhood associations. And, of course, we took out an ad in I can't remember which
Daily
newspaper
Journal
it was. The Daily Journal of Commerce, yes.
Okay, thank you. And how much is the residential fee for a sewer conversion? How does that compare with the new residential branch fee?
It's the same. So unless we have an agreement with them that it's lower, because there are a few that are lower, it's currently $5,059. It's subject to the rate changes each year, and that's based on the actual cost of building a branch. And they only pay that if we believe or we know that we are going to have to build them a branch to serve them.
And how do you figure out what significant financial hardship is?
Well, we have a program that's been in place since the old Mid-County days called the Safety Net Program, and there is a means test with that. It's a lot simpler than the Mid-County days, from what I understand. My group does not do that. That's done through another portion of the Bureau, but it's been in operation for quite some time, and it is operating very efficiently.
So it'll be the same
yes.
for this program. And how about the deferral for the criteria for deferral?
It's pretty much the same as it was, except that we have expanded our ability to do it in response to technical complications. We have a little bit more flexibility to grant them because of the needs of the contingencies that a property owner may have that are more unique than what we used to have in the old with the cesspool type of deferrals. And we are probably going to be pretty liberal with those when sewer's not immediately available. When there are sewers immediately available, that means there's a sewer in front. We will also be pretty open to technical issues or there's something in the way, that type of thing. But remembering that if their plumbing is going across somebody else's property, it's very difficult for us to grant permission for people to have more time when there's another property owner involved who's saying they want them off immediately or they're going to cap them.
And is the decision maker still the director of BES?
Yes.
Is it, okay. Make sure I'm understanding this right. The previous rule was if they were within 100 feet of a sewer that they have to connect under this mm-hmm. change, it would be 1,000 feet. Is that correct? No?
No.
Okay. So no. What's the changes in when it's mandatory to connect?
Well, it's mandatory to connect if it's within reach, and that's usually considered to be 100 feet. I believe the 1,000 feet has to do with failed septic systems and when we will do a sewer extension. I'm not quite sure where the 1,000 is coming from. It has nothing to do with this.
We can look into that over
the course. Yeah, I can look into it and find out where you're getting the 1,000 feet.
And when would a, this is my last question, when would a person with a non-conforming SUA status be brought before a code hearings officer?
Well,